Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Moment. On Tuesday, March 30th, President Biden announced new actions to address the ongoing violence against Asian Americans. Some of these new actions include the Justice Department tracking these hate crimes and expanding its outreach to community organizations, but also the FBI is going to begin holding training sessions with local law enforcement. Now, these recent events really weighed heavily on many of us, and Marcus and I talked about it, so I decided to reach out to my dear, dear friend, Trisha Wong. Trisha has researched the social evolution of the Chinese internet. She's written about the elastic self, which is an emergent form of interaction in a virtual world, to take us through the history of anti-Asian racism, help us outline some of the actions we can take to combat it, and basically tell us a bit about what this past year has been like for herself, her family, and her community.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Trisha, I wanted you to explain to me and our listeners, you know, what were your immediate thoughts to when you found out about the recent shootings in Atlanta?
Of course this happened. Like, why, what would we expect after a year of pinning this pandemic on Asians, on especially Chinese people? And what do you expect after 4 years of a president that empowered white supremacists? Everyone feeling so emboldened after the storming of the Capitol. I immediately went into planning mode because I know what happens, you know, when this kind of stuff happens. I've been seeing it happen, which is like media want to pin this as a Black versus Asian thing and to make it even more divisive. And I was just like, we have to make sure that we're ahead of the misinfo. Any kind of memes, negative, you know, racist memes or efforts to make Asian people more fearful of Black people, even though the act was committed by a white person, at least in Atlanta. But it's just so complicated. And I was just like, there's just going to be a release of stuff. And some, it's just like, we're going to have to be one step ahead in terms of organizing. And we have to speak out that this is unacceptable. I just immediately thought about the killing of Vincent Chen in Detroit in 1982, where two white people killed him. It was someone who used a bat and smashed his brain, you know, never came back to his 4 days before his wedding. He was at a bachelor. It was his bachelor party. He was in Detroit. And the two men got off with $3,000 fine and no jail sentence, you know. I think about all the women, Black women who were killed in Boston, and when Barbara Smith and the co-founders of the Combahee River Collective came together. I just think, like, across all communities, whether it's Black or Muslim or Asian Pacific Islander, there's at some point, there's a set of murders that happen. It always is some kind of taking of life that mobilizes people to come together and to organize. And so while this incident is horrific, I just know that I'm seeing my community, I'm seeing us, we're speaking up more, being more vocal. So this is a turning point. And this is a turning point. It's another ongoing history of coalition building and solidarity with groups who have been on more on the violent, more of the, you know, in terms of murders, on the murderous end of the white supremacist experience over the last few decades, especially Muslim and Black communities. I think it's a time for us to continue organizing with them. So yeah, and building more solidarity. So I went into action planning mode. I didn't really grieve as much, but that's just my personality, is I grieve you know, in a different way, and probably will come later.
Trisha, Stop AAPI Hate Asian American Pacific Islanders recently released a report that there have been 3,800 documented. These are only the documented hate crimes against Asians from the start of the pandemic until February 28th, 2021. Almost 70% of these 3,800 documented hate crimes were reported by women. So I'd like to, you know, for you personally, what have these past 12 months been like?
Look, my past 12 months have been very sheltered. You know, I have been working from home. I'm not an essential worker. So I'm mainly in my apartment. So I'm not having to risk my life out there every day and getting to get sick, you know, to work and having to travel on the subway. So my life is limited in that way. But also I live in an incredibly diverse neighborhood. I don't live in a concentrated neighborhood of, like, you know, primarily Asians. I think in our community, at least in Brooklyn, this is a very diverse and strong community. And I feel very safe in this area. And, you know, it's been, but what I have been fearful of is for, like, my family who lives in Oakland, and my grandmother, who I say she can't go on walks alone anymore. She's 92 years old, and she used to walk, you know, a couple miles a day on her own. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's not happening.
No.
Trying to convince, you know, my mother just to, like, you know, just to be more careful. But it's been a hard one, because I also am trying to work on my family to make sure that it doesn't go in the area of misinfo, or fall into any of racism, because, you know, a lot of what's happened in Oakland has all the victims are Asians in Chinatown. And it just so happens the community next to Chinatown is a Black community. And a lot of the people who have been, you know, harassing or harming Asian people have been Black in that area. And I just have to really work on my family to make sure that whatever they say, whatever happens, that they don't fall into or lean into any of the racist kind of misinfo that's in fake news that's spreading in, like, you know, their chat groups. I have to be like, no, these are the incidents, and this is not at all Black people are like this. And that's what I work on, like, on a very personal level for me. But I have not been on the experiencing end of it. But I'm always extra careful, though.
Yeah. I mean, when I...
That's a Brooklyn I in me, you know?
When I... again, March 19th, when I found out about the shooting, another thought that I had was just that, yeah, this makes total sense. I mean, a pillar of white supremacist oppressive tactics is divide and conquer. Always has been.
Exactly.
It's a, you know, colonial.
Exactly.
It's a pillar of colonial strategizing to oppress and conquer nations and peoples. The divisiveness between minority groups in the United States has such an old history. The Irish were pitted against the Italians, the Irish and the Italians against the Blacks, or against the Jewish community, or against the Asian community. It seemed to me, again, that this is just a continuation of, like, a very kind of American story.
Yeah. And I would say that they're victims of not only white supremacy, but white supremacy is caught up is truly, I think, it's hard to disentangle white supremacy from capitalism at all costs. You know, I think that's why, like, looking at intersectionality is very important, which is that none of these issues are just that white supremacy and capitalism are caught up together, because it's an investment in a system. It's totalizing, you know. And so what happened there is a ongoing issue with that. In America, at least with Asians, is that we are pitted against each other by propped up as the model minority, and white people analyze and say, hey, these are the minority. Like, why are you Black people, Latinos? Why can't you be hardworking like Asians? You know? And that is a really problematic myth, because then it creates this divisive, it creates further divides in the community. And also, there are policies that are set in place that make it easier for Asians to get loans, you know, where the Black people can't have access to. And they've been here. They've been born here. And so the tensions are real, but you can't, it's not, you have to look at it in terms of also capitalism and how it's all tied together. yeah, no, it's part of a long system. And that's why in America, we always have to have the other. And so that I think that's part of what American history is about, is understanding how the other and the dangerous other and the fear of the other constantly moves. And you have to have, you have to frame that as in order to like, and so I think what's exciting is that like, how do we frame a country where it's not always having to be based on demonizing another, where we can just be proud of the celebration of the joy. And that's why I think like cultures that bring us together, like hip hop, like music, they celebrate community and storytelling. It's inclusive enough that like hip hop doesn't say, you know, yes, it was started by Black and Latino communities, but it's inclusive enough to really welcome and have space for everyone. But we need, that's why we need to invest in culture, because that's the kind of stuff that brings people together. And it allows us to imagine a new story, a new way of conceptualizing what it means to, you know, be an American or to be in America, residents of this place. And it's not based on this constant other, which is based on this idea, at least for Asians, is based on this idea of the yellow peril, right? That was started in Europe. It started in Europe. I mean, white supremacy so and capitalism,
all evil, not all, but so many of the modern evils started in Europe. We know that colonialism, capitalism, but I didn't know that the yellow peril expression or way of thinking stemmed from Europe. I thought that was wholly American.
No, it was a Russian sociologist who created the term, and then like the Germans like snapped it up. And what it was used to justify the invasion of Asia. And they compared, you know, Asians to being like apes, and that they were so sexual that they would take over in population. So, you know, Germans came up with some crazy shit like that. Nazism was not born out of nowhere with Hitler. There's a long precedence. It's infrastructural. And there was a whole design of a system of Germany going to other European countries saying, we need to band together because the yellow peril is coming. So we need to, the person who promoted it in Germany came up with the whole idea of polygamy so that men could have as much sex as they want and have as many babies to counter the counter the yellow peril that was coming. So yeah, it's pretty terrible. And a lot of European nations bought into it. And you think about the connection to, you know, England, to the British Empire invading China and just feeding the country opium, and like it all is mapped. It all comes together.
It also connects with
the yellow peril.
Tricia, as you know, I mean, you've spent a lot of time in Sweden. I know. I think it's fair to say a part of you loves Sweden. Is that? That's not exaggerating.
Oh, yeah.
You love Sweden.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe specifically Malmo.
Malmo. Yeah, I was going to say there's a specific part of the country I love, which is Skåne.
Yeah, and which makes me, as a Skånian, it makes me very happy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that part of Sweden.
What you're saying about the yellow peril and its roots in Germany makes me instantly think of replacement theory, which has trickled into mainstream media. You can hear it echoed by not only alt-right, but conservative politicians in Sweden, a lot of journalists too. And that's this, I think that also has its roots kind of in German Nazism of basically that hordes of uneducated, poor criminal, savage, and today that's code for Muslims, are going to invade, you know, just flood into Sweden, and with the help of course, Jews and leftists, destroy Swedishness and Swedish whiteness and so forth. So it's funny, or not funny, but it's really fascinating how these things go in cycles, right? That the yellow peril came before, and now you have replacement theory, and now the culprit, at least in the Nordic countries, is not Asians. It's Arabs, Muslims, across the board, more or less.
Right. It's not Asians right now until because of the idea that we are the honorary whites, you know, that is the term, that is a concept that is like, you're the, because again, of the model minority myth until it turns, you know, because that's the thing with white supremacy is that you just, it always needs somebody, it needs a group of people, and it's all based on fear.
It needs scapegoats, yeah.
Yeah. But also, it's the same thing underlying it. There's also it's also a class thing because there's a fear of loss of life, of livelihood. And so you have to blame it on somebody. You know, in all of the Asian issues around anti-API issues here in the US, a lot of that has always been like Asians coming in and taking jobs. Same thing with Mexicans or with Latinos, you know, and with Black people being like, oh, they're going to just like, it's always like these economic underlying this replacement theory is the scarcity, idea of scarcity, and that these other people are taking away our beautiful way of life and they don't understand our values. And so it's horrific because what it does is that it creates this binary and it's all about sorting people into boxes and I think that a lot of what perpetuates it, what's different now than it was like back then in like the, let's say late 1800s when Yellow Peril was created, is that we have tech platforms now. We have algorithms. So the issue is not, I want to be careful. I don't want to say the problem is social media in itself. The problem is the way that we now spend, mediate a lot of our lives online and how we get information is through tech platforms, is through social media. And it just so happens that the way that current social media is designed is that these algorithms, all they're doing is pattern matching that by serving you information. You click on one thing, it doesn't look at meaning behind it. All the algorithm is saying is you clicked on this one thing, it automatically says, we will serve you more of the same thing. And that's, I think, what is also feeding this of what's happened over the last, especially the last 4 years, is that the internet is great in that you can find all this information, but it makes everything more visible, everything more legible. And so it means that white supremacists can more easily connect with other white supremacists also. And misinfo can also find its way to the people who are likely to click on it. And even people who don't feel, who weren't like my mother, who is not,
heavily into social media, I assume.
But she gets the information.
She does.
But yeah. She gets it because of
because
misinfo,
it becomes
because
it all, the word
that's
on the
how
streets.
Pervasive
yeah,
is.
It becomes public opinion.
Exactly.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall that the first AI produced tweet was a very racist tweet.
Was
anyway,
it?
Wasn't it? I may be wrong about that.
Oh, I mean, I do know about the 20. I mean, there is a there's Microsoft's AI chatbot called Tay that was on Twitter. I don't know if it's the first AI written tweet, but it is a chatbot by Microsoft, and it became racist because of the data that it was trained on Twitter. So I don't know if that's the one you're referring to, but that was a really big issue. And it was, and it just goes to show that like, you can't just launch technology into the wild without thinking about the data that's trained on.
Especially,
and the context.
I mean, especially not when it's modeled after us and we've far from moved past these issues. Of course, we're going to insert that into the tech that we build, even if it carries the kind of surname intelligence. But okay, Patricia, when you're in New York City, which is, I dare say, the most multicultural city in the world, and also making it just the only city where hip hop could be born is also where it was born. It's New York City, Brooklyn, where you live. But your family lives in Oakland, and as you just said, you know, you tend to worry more for them than for yourself. How do you feel, you know, how does it affect you when you, you know, get off the plane in when you're in Northern California? Are you much more vigilant and more, are you more scared when you're there than when you're in Brooklyn?
Look, I'm more worried whenever there's not as many people. So this is why I love density. Mm. I love being in New York City because there's always people around. Mm. I actually became, you know, more worried over the last decade as my neighborhood became more gentrified, because in here in Brooklyn, we have a whole stoop culture where you're always out on the streets and people, there's always eyes on the streets and people looking out for people. Mm-hmm. And in the summer, it's just the best part of Brooklyn is going around and you see people barbecuing out front. And there's just, I could walk home late at night, no matter what. And there's always someone on the stoop, you know, to look out for me. And as the neighborhood has gentrified, as more white people have moved in, is that that culture has slowly disappeared and white people don't say hi to each other as much. I would say white and Asians, they just don't understand the culture of New York City, which is that you got to look out for each other. Mm. You know, that that closeness
you get to know your
comes
neighbors
from,
and you talk to your neighbors.
Exactly. Because because you can't rely on the cops. You know, New York City, that you don't call the, you try not to call the cops, you know? So I have been more worried here over the last 10 years as density has disappeared, but also as the culture has changed and people spend more time indoors. So in the same way that I would be more worried, I'd be worried in the Oakland for the same reasons. It's just that there's just not as many people on the streets. And so, but I'm always aware though, this is the Brooklynite in me, is that I'm ready to bash someone's head in at any fucking moment. So I will
That's why I feel very safe when I walk with you. Because I know you have eyes.
I'm always ready.
That's a, so I feel, I always feel very safe when walking with you. And also, Trisha, this is another argument for why we have to talk more about your move to Sweden, because if you think there's less stoop culture in Brooklyn as it's gentrifying, come and hang out in Stockholm for a week or two. There is zero
stoop. I don't want to. This is why I'm not moving to Stockholm.
Malmo, or Malmo, or Malmo. There's very little stoop
culture. I'm moving to
Malmö
where... I'm moving to Malmö where I, where is the most diverse part of Scandinavia.
Yeah, there's definitely the highest chance of you, that having that sense of community and neighbors actually saying hi to each other. But I'd say this, it's not a lot of it here in the Nordic region.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
I'd specifically like to ask you of your personal experiences of racism, even before the pandemic. The past the past president was being pretty explicitly anti-Asian in a lot of ways, you know, and in a lot of his language. How was it for you growing up? What were some of the experiences you had with this growing up?
Well, I think look, I had a really interesting childhood in that for the first 9 years of my life, I was raised in the Bay Area, and we lived in San Jose, and I grew up in a really diverse community. Like everybody was there in San Jose, all immigrant groups. And all of a sudden at the age of 9 years old, Overnight, we moved. My mother was like, okay, we're going to move into the suburbs. We moved 2 hours north into a town called Roseville. Mm. And it was a newly created suburb. And I remember the first day there, we went into a grocery store and this white child and a white mother were in, they were in a cart and they looked over at us and the little girl started screaming and they just like had never seen anyone look like us before, you know? And they screamed and they just like ran away. And then I was like, what was that all about? And what I realized was that we were the first Chinese family that I know of, you know, there may have been others, but that was my experience, was that I couldn't see anyone else looking like me. I went into school, I remember the next week, and it was a total shift. People started calling me Chink and Chinese and a communist and go back to China. And I was 9 years old. I didn't know what this was. I was like, what is a Chink? Like, what is it? Like, I knew I was Chinese, but it was like, why are they calling me Chinese in a derogatory way? Mm. Why are they calling me a communist? Mm. And then it was, and I didn't put it together until like later on in life, I think like as a teenager, that I was like, oh, Tiananmen Square just happened, 1989. Mm-hmm. And all people saw in the news were the tanks, and the violence and the murders of Chinese citizens. Mm. And it was really interesting because that was, my experience was just, people are very surprised that like I grew up around such extreme racism. So that was just like the tip of it. It was like most of my experience was every day was like, I got into fights all the time. I think I went to school in a very racist administration. I was outspoken and I wrote about racism and they didn't like it. And I remember just even like driving in our car. I still to this day have a fear of large trucks. And there was, I think, Nazis, like they were men with like bald and they had like swastika signs in their arms and their trucks. And they would just like scream at my mother and I, just, you know, telling us to go back to China. This was like a regular experience. Our house would get egged all the time. Mm. So I think like, and I think a lot of people are surprised. People are like, what? That's California. I'm like, okay, California is incredibly segregated. You said, New York City is the place that is most mixed, but it's not like that in the rest of the United States. And the place I grew up in was highly affluent, highly Republican. Not that there necessarily has to be a correlation between being Republican and being racist, but it just so happens that it was... That was what it was like in my neighborhood, and it was, people are just like shocked. They're like, I don't understand that, like how, and I have like scars on my knees from like fights, you know, from people putting gum in my hair, and just constantly being, now I know the word is being bullied, but I didn't know, that was, I was just like, this is, you know, my brother went through it too. It wasn't just me. That transition to me as like an adult, like the experiences are pretty crazy too, because of how Asian women are hyper eroticized and sexualized is, I move in circles that are pretty senior. But at conferences, I have a very different experience. I think like a lot of, I mean, women are always sexualized, but I think there's Asian women are hyper, you know, I mean, Black women are sexualized too. Like it's like all women of color are always extra seen as objects. But I think Asian American women go through a particular experience that is, I think, even more extreme, as we've seen, like in these shootings. Like I think like really well-meaning people would be like, oh, how do you feel about the shootings? I'd be like, okay, here's how I feel. And they'd be like, well, so do you think he really did it because he was racist or because he's like has a real sex addiction and because he really was trying to, he thought they were sex workers. So I'm like, why are you asking that question in the first place? The fact that you're asking that question goes to show how messed up your thinking is, because it doesn't even matter if they were sex workers or not, you know, but because Asian women are hypersexualized, I think people really wonder like, so were they sex workers or not? And it's like, who gives a shit?
That becomes just a way of victim blaming anyway. So would it be more okay if they were? I mean, what's the implication there that it would be more okay if they were sex workers? Also, I mean, the fact that the police chief said that the murderer was having a bad day. I mean, that, of course, speaks maybe more to the murderer's race than the crime itself. Right. If he wasn't white, and they wouldn't talk about it that way.
And on the police chief on Facebook, they have found like photos of him wearing a shirt about saying how the COVID is from China. So, yeah, it just goes to show, it's just more stories about how people, white people are protected, you know, when they commit acts of white supremacy.
And Tricia, you mentioned before that trying to stem or counter the flow of fake news and racist memes and so forth. How do you realistically go about doing that? I just feel personally in my life, there is just, I many times feel like there's almost no point to trying to get at public opinion when it sways in these fake newsy directions, because fake news is synthetic truth that people digest so much easier than looking into the complexities of actual truth. How do you go about that in your kind of, in your work, in your daily life?
I mean, it's definitely not impossible to counter because but it's these systems are not dependent on just one individual. Mm. Like, so we have to acknowledge that these are infrastructural issues with algorithms and with people who, and there's a whole financial system that benefits from these algorithms. This is all, these are all based on advertising money. It always comes back to there's money involved. Absolutely. At the end of the day, yeah, for these kind of models of, because they need you to keep clicking. Mm. I personally counter it by acknowledging what power I have by my platform and just always making sure that I post information that I would want to read. And then when I hear it personally from people I know, like, am I, let's say, just like my friends or family, you just talk to them about it. Mm. But I would say like fake news is almost not like my biggest issue. My biggest issue right now that we have to deal with is that beliefs or illusions of safety for the kind of solutions that Asians would call for. So there are legitimate calls supposedly for more cops and more patrolling of Chinatown or places to have more massage parlors. Mm-hmm. And what we know historically and to this day with evidence of not just how cops treat Asians, but in particular how cops treat all minority groups, especially Black people, is that cops are not to be trusted. Mm. I'm not talking about individual cops. I'm talking about as an institution, we do not need more policing because the evidence goes to show that they are the danger. You know, we have people dying because of cops, increased policing in our neighborhoods. You know, what's holding the community together right now is what I look at is what I point to is like, look at the amazing solidarity that's coming together from like, you know, we have Peter Kerr, who's a Black, you know, Brooklynite who created the group Street Writers New York City. And it was his call that's led to like thousands of people signing up to escort Asian Pacific Islander people walking home from the subway or to the subway or to work. You know, you have the massage parlor outreach project in Seattle that was, formed to protect massage parlors. You have all this mutual aid group. There was like a Latino, like a young 26-year-old Latino person in Oakland. His name was Jacob Azevedo, who created this org called Compassion in Oakland, and where it's also just escorting Asian API people, you know, to work in their everyday lives. And I just think it's like efforts like these that are truly community based, that to goes to show that like we know what to do. We have solutions. This is a moment of coming together that we don't need like more cops. This is like, this is the thing that we really need to focus on right now, that we need to come together over, that community-based activism knows how to resolve these things that are culturally specific.
What needs to be done to encourage more crossover in activism between different groups? And it's not, you know, just between Blacks and Asians or, you know, but in class, geography, but notably between minority groups that sometimes feel far from each other or don't identify as the same.
I think the way we address that is that you have to understand your history. Mm. That's like not the most popular answer. But I think one is to really understand how these things are not new and they come. And when you look at your history, you understand that what it's linked to and how there's a pattern, which is that imperialism, colonialism, white supremacy are all linked together in an effort to divide so that we can be pitted against each other. Mm. The second thing I think is to understand that this is not a binary. And I think that's really important because around the world, I know people were shocked. Like people are always shocked when I say Asian, this is not new. Mm. So I think it's like, and people are like, what? Asian people experience racism? It's like, everybody experiences racism,
that's how racism except, works.
You know, in a white supremacist world. Yeah. And I think I think a more nuanced answer is to go back to what Barbara Smith, who is one of the co-founders of the Combahee River Collective, came up with the term identity politics. And the word identity politics is so misunderstood right now.
Please break it down for us.
Oh my God.
For our Swedish listeners, that definitely needs to be broken down.
We need a whole episode on that. We're not going to get deep. I think you need to do a whole episode with Barbara Smith. But really, the term that she, when she created that, the whole entire collective created that, it was just like, all they were saying is that, like, we need, as Black feminists, as Black women, Black queer women, need to be able to, everybody, but not just them, but everybody needs to be able to determine their own political future. Because your livelihood is at risk. Because when you can't determine and affect political change, you don't get represented. And if you're not seen as human, you don't have an identity.
Right.
You know, this is just period, is that, like, a lot of people were not even recognized as a group. And that's all they meant. The work that, the way they went about doing their work was incredibly intersectional, in that she was saying, as a queer Black feminist, my issues are not just because I am Black. It's because I'm also a woman. And it's also because of my sexuality. That you can't just isolate, that oppression works across, it doesn't just operate in one category. You know, it's across gender, race, and sexuality, and, you know, across a myriad of other issues.
Class.
And so I think it's like, that's why I mean by, like, get over binaries. If you really, like, all of us need to do that. And I have to continue in my effort in that, to constantly see that it is that all these things do come together and you can't reduce it. So that's why I don't like when people are like, well, if you could just reduce it to one thing, what is it? And it's like, no, that's not how it works. We're in a complex system. And so I look to activists like Barbara Smith. I look to elders like her, and I look to elders like Grace Lee Boggs, who died at 100 years old, who was working, you know, it was one of the loudest civil rights organizers, you know, organizing, in Detroit, when all the factories closed down, all of a sudden Black and white people lost their jobs overnight. Entire towns were decimated. So I think there's, like, a lot of good activists to look at and role models. And I think we need to celebrate them, because I think, like, especially a lot of young organizers I remind myself, like, this is not new. We have elders who came before us and people who have been figuring this out. And so we can't we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but also we have all these new ways of organizing that are so much faster. We should be able to use technology and use social media, but we have to meet the community where it's at. And I think that's why looking at local groups, like looking at what this one group in Chinatown is doing, or in New York City, it's called Red Canary Song. They organized after a woman died because police were, like, chasing her and trying to arrest her for being possibly a sex worker. And these kind of moments, you have local groups coming together. And I think it's like, we need to all commit to these kind of local efforts that are hyper-local, because that's where change is made. You know, this is not about some, like, broad advocacy. Like, we need advocacy and we need policy change, but also the work happens on a local level of getting to know people in your neighborhood, saying hello to them, and figuring out what needs attention. So I would say, like, everybody should figure out what's happening in your neighborhood. And sometimes those issues may not be Asian related. Like, right now, I'm not working just on a Asian issue. No. You know, my time is right now as a co-founder of a nonprofit during COVID that protects communities most impacted by it. My work reaches primarily right now Indigenous Black and Latino communities. You know, it just so happens that's where I'm organizing right now.
Yeah, but I love that perspective, because I can myself say that I can sometimes be hesitant to address issues because you know, I tend to look at it from a too big a picture, from too far away. And what can one person do against all that? But what you're saying is reverse that and look at what you can do on your street, on your block, in your community, amongst the people that you meet, and address the issues, needs that are going on there. But also, and maybe more importantly, what I'm hearing you say is basically reaching out to the people in your community that you don't normally speak to, or that you don't know who they are. And let me say this, Tricia, also, because I'm constantly in translation between the United States and Sweden. And in Sweden, as you know, and we've spoken about a lot, grassroots community organizing is not very common. And it's something that I think some are struggling to catch up and learn. Others are not aware that this is even missing from our lives. And yet, and still, to me, I see it as, you know, you know, the pandemic breaks out and there's not even an effort in the building where I live, where there are a lot of, I'd say 85% of the people that live are senior citizens. And there's not even a collective effort to help our neighbors buy groceries if, you know, if they're...
Why would they need to? The state can do it.
Exactly. And that's, of course, that's the answer to why we've kind of forgotten this, because of course there was community organizing in Sweden before social democracy, but after social democracy, doing such an efficient job at kind of lifting the broad public as... you know, the public health and eradicating poverty at such a broad and efficient level, then organic communities became, I guess, less important. But now, as social democracy is being dismantled, and most of it being dismantled, the need for organic community building and the possibility to do that with the knowledge and the motivation to do that when crises happen is very obvious to me. So again, I just wanted to say that your advice really, that's very, very inspiring advice, especially sitting here in Sweden.
Yeah. And I'm like, tactically speaking, there's a whole effort called, you know, Call on Me, Not the Cops, that came out of 18 Million Rising out of Florida. And I love that effort where, it's just like there's, you just talk to people and be like, hey, if you have an issue, just like call me, not the cops. But when we're talking about like, you know, what can one do? I also think people need to be prepared to take trainings to speak up. What I love is that the Center for Anti-Violence has a whole training on how to be a good bystander and how to move from being a bystander to an upstander. There's Instagram account called, you know, at iHollowback. And I'll send you all these links.
I love that. From bystander to upstander.
Yeah. Where they have a training on the 5 D's of how to be a good upstander, you know, distract, delegate, document, delay, and direct. And this started out as an effort to end gender-based harassment, but it's now moved on to any forms of harassment. This is something that I think, like, especially Swedish people, but I think everyone should learn, is how do you, what do you do in moments where it's not relying on you as an individual, but if you see something, how do you become a voice to try and intervene? You know, and I like that because like the first one of distract is just asking the perpetrator who's doing the harassment, just be like to distract them, be like, hey, can you tell me what time it is? The thing is not to be, their first action is don't like, you know, not to be like some righteous, self-righteous person coming
in.
You just want to first distract. Yeah. And then the second thing, de-delegate, of just like asking someone, telling someone like, hey, this person is being harassed. Can you help this person? It's, I love that because it's not, the solution is not just dependent on you, but it's saying, hey, as a community, as everyone, if you care about this, take a training on how to be an upstander so that when it happens and something happens in front of you, you know how to deal with it, you know? And I think that like, that's why in the US, I really love the trainings that like Colin Kaepernick has been doing with his organization of Know Your Rights. It's the same effort of like, you need to know your rights so that when you get stopped or you watch someone being stopped or illegally being searched and being profiled, you know how to document that situation in the way that will create the least amount of harm to all parties. Because without that kind of training with, or without that kind of awareness, me being like this, I'm more of a firecracker. I just want to be like, what the fuck? But like, I have learned that that can create more trouble, you know, like, especially in a system where a cop is already aggravated and freaking out. Like, you have to approach that with great sensitivity so you don't escalate.
This should be taught in schools. It's as active measures to counter bullying, which goes on in many schools, you know, I'm sure all across the world.
The energy of what's coming out of, there's like one phrase to sum up what's happening out because of the murder is like speak up. Like, we cannot stay silent. And I think that's why the upstander and these kind of trainings are so important. Is that you have to speak up and there's so much work you can do. Like, don't be silent. And I think that's something that like I've always taken into my life is like speak up for all forms of injustice because that that is that's like, what else can you do? Like, this is the best thing we could be doing as human beings is to speak up when you see, because you would want someone to do that for you, right? And so speak up and like look out for, like just care, operate from a place of care. Like, you know, I love that. I would love to know in the next time we talk that you've knocked on some doors in your building to check on the elderly people and just be like, hey, like call on me. By the way, if you need help, if anything happens, I'm in this building, you know? This is my number. Like, I'm in this apartment
I did
number.
About a month into the pandemic when when I noticed that that was not going on and realized
that's
that,
incredible.
Yeah, well, it's not going on, then that needs to happen, you know. But Sweden's very much a mind your own business culture. But, you know, I have a pretty good relationship with a lot of my neighbors, but yet and still it's kind of a social taboo to, you know, it's like nobody has ever knocked on my door to ask for a, you know, like an egg or a cup of sugar or some milk or, but I know lots of people in my building must have run out of these things. I knocked once and asked for some milk and I got it. That was fine. You know, the Swedish thing to do then would be like, if my neighbor knocked on my door and I gave them like a cup of milk, they would come, they'd like within, if not within hours, but like the next day it would have to happen. They would have to buy me new milk to replace the milk.
It'd be cool, funny to do a documentary of just like a training of Swedes of some basic American.
And Trisha, I think I've changed
like
my mind.
Looking each other in the eye.
I definitely think you should move to Sweden. We need this kind of, you know, just clear, true, concrete and honest advice on how to be citizens, upstanding neighbors and fellow humans. And I love that about you too, Trisha. You always have like tangible advice on like, well, do this, take these steps. Or have you tried looking at it this way? Tools, you have tools and you're very good at sharing the tools. So I really appreciate that, Trisha.
Convince the government to give me citizenship. I'll be there.
Yeah, well, I don't know about citizenship, but you could definitely come over here and live. Trisha, thank you so much for coming on this moment and inspiring me, as you always do.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you all our listeners. Follow us on Instagram at This Moment Podcast. Our email is thismomentpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you again next week. So until then, peace out.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.